to teach us to rely totally and only upon Christ. It was a hard lesson to learn because we had to keep relearning it on higher and higher levels. We left Salt Lake City late in March on a beautiful spring morning. Flowers were just beginning to bloom. It was warmer than expected, and grass was green everywhere you looked. The spring had been quite rainy, and the world of plants seemed to explode with flowers and greenery. We departed on I-15 heading north. We moved at a slow pace because most of our company was afoot. We were not in a hurry. Before we left that morning, we met in council, and after discussion and prayer, we agreed upon our route and our distance of travel. We were not just going to Cardston. We were the Lord's camp, and we were content to go wherever the Lord sent us and for it to take us as long as it took. We soon realized that the big truck and pickups could not travel at a walking pace economically. We sent them ahead and carefully calculated their best economic speed, which they used throughout the remainder of our journey. We caught up with them each evening, where camp was already being set up. I was on foot as well and often helped carry infants or whatever else people needed. We were full of hope, and as our heritage song says, we did, with joy, wend our way. We often left the highway to travel on side roads because the earthquake had leveled long stretches of the freeway or opened caverns across it. Sometimes our foot traffic caught up with the trucks as they pondered how to cross some obstacle. Many of these obstacles were natural, but there were also those consisting of barricades made and defended by people, as well as other caravans along the way. The first part of our journey was without worry, except that the Lord had sent us around one area that had been hit by a nuclear weapon. This explosion had not occurred because of aerial strike, but by sabotage of a nuclear weapon stored underground at that place. I believe that many of the nuclear explosions across the country were a result of sabotage rather than a missile attack. A few days after we crossed into Idaho, we left all highways and went cross-country. Idaho had been rocked by several atomic weapons, all at military installations, probably also due to sabotage. We were completely responsive to the voice of the Lord and were led around those areas. We learned by experience that the highways and roads were where most of our problems arose. If some armed band was accosting caravans and robbing them, it was on the highways. If there was impassable damage, it was on the highways. Our big truck was perfect for cross-country. It rolled across everything, including fences, leaving behind wide tracks for smaller vehicles and foot traffic. The further we went, the more we valued the big thing. We were also not on a direct course to Canada. Each morning the council met and prayerfully planned each day. Some days we were given the name of a family, a person, or sometimes a ward or town to minister to. Sometimes it was just an impression to go toward a farm or town. We would determine by the Spirit how many were to go, and they would leave in the morning, taking with them whatever the Spirit directed. Sometimes we took items that the people we met desperately needed, and we were able to trade for more fuel or fresh meat or vegetables. Sometimes our mechanics went and traded for parts. Sometimes we would knock on a farmhouse door, and the people within had been warned by the Lord, like unto Lehi, to be prepared to leave. We would show up just as they were walking out of their home. Every imaginable thing happened as we traveled, and we learned to never fear because the Lord was ever present in our journey. Gifts of the Spirit. The power of the priesthood was manifest often in healings and other miracles. Not everyone had the same gifts. We found that some had great faith to heal and others to prophesy. Even children and teens had their gifts, and we embraced all that came from God. There were those among us who had an ability I had not seen before, which was the ability to speak and teach with so much power that even our enemies were pacified and their hearts were softened toward us. This convincing gift did not flow from powerful oratory or long and mighty speaking. Their words were just softly spoken, mostly without eloquence, but what they said could not be disbelieved when their gift was manifest. We found this to be a mighty gift and reserved it to those times when the Lord sanctioned its use, usually when we were trapped and had no other way to continue our journey. My gifts grew along with most all of our company. Many of us developed the ability to read the hearts of men. We often met other caravans or small groups of people going in every direction. They would approach us with great caution because of our military truck. I was often in the group that went out to meet with these traveling bands. We found when we looked at them as we approached that we knew their intent and their needs. We also knew how to reply when they were lying to us. As we left to parley with them, we often were told by the Spirit what to bring with us to trade with them. Since we were in Idaho, quite often these were good Latter-day Saints trying to make their way to Salt Lake City or some other place. Often they were going to find their families in other parts of the country, or even trying to journey to Missouri. These we fed and shared provisions with, and sometimes we invited them to join us. Sometimes we urged them to return to their homes and build Zion where they were from. They rarely followed our counsel, and I do not know what happened to them. But most often these chance encounters were not with people we were directed to gather. We were sent to those we gathered. We went to their homes, into their cities, and onto their farms under guidance from God. We went to them. Build Zion where you are. When we first entered a city, we would go to the local leaders of the church in each town. Often the leaders would ask us to speak to their people, and we would spread the word. We would meet these people outside of town, build a big fire, and have a true fireside. We told them what happened since the earthquake in Salt Lake and how the Lord was advancing the work of the latter days. Everyone was curious about what happened in Salt Lake City, as rumors had circulated of both awful and glorious things. We were pleased to update their view of the work of the latter days and thereby give them a correct vision of the unfolding strength of the latter-day kingdom. If the Spirit accorded, we told them who we were and what our mission was. The convincing power of God would move some of them to join us, and we welcomed them. However, much more often we taught them to continue building Zion where they were, and to prepare themselves spiritually to receive the Lord when He came. I don't want to give the impression that everyone who was worthy was being gathered into our company. This was not the case. We had been authorized by the brethren to represent the church wherever we went, and most often the Spirit led us to counsel them to stay where they were. Most of the local leaders we met already understood that they were to gather where they were and to make holy the ground upon which they presently stood. Their gathering place was there or somewhere nearby. We generally found the saints to be in good spirits, with strong hopes, and often, but not always, possessing a fullness of the priesthood, just as we had obtained it. If they were lacking, we counseled and admonished them to repent and live up to their potential. Almost without exception, they humbly and gratefully received our words and began their spiritual journey to Zion without fear. The people of the Lord's church did not represent a scene of starving people hunkering in basements waiting without hope. Those who survived were chosen for these times before the world was created, and they arose with great faith and willingness to do the Lord's work. They were not lost, they were home. Sometimes all we needed to do was to point this out with the convincing power of the Spirit. There were also gatherings of people not in the church who were full of the Spirit and doing the Lord's work, increasing their faith and living without fear. We were led to these at times. When we were, we blessed and uplifted them and left them in the hands of God to continue their work. We fully expected to see them someday in Zion. But we first had to make our own way there and build it. This was the focus of our hearts and minds. While among the saints, we always traded with them. We occasionally had just what they needed, and they had things we were in need of. One thing we were always bartering for was fuel, and we found people willing to trade because you can't eat fuel, and there were no roads to drive on. We found we could get used engine oil and inedible deep fryer oil for almost nothing, yet our faithful big truck could burn it all. It just gave off an interesting exhaust that smelled of French fries. We always continued our journey with sufficient for our needs. I don't recall ever exchanging money, gold, or silver. These were relatively worthless. What mattered was food and necessities. During this leg of our journey, I don't recall ever seeing a miracle to provide loaves and fishes or fuel. We had the mindset that the Lord expected us to provide for our needs and that He would lead us to obtain them. We developed complete faith in this process. We learned much later, however, that this is a lesser law, and that we were really being brought to a greater faith that would allow us to rely upon him for everything. We learned this in greater degrees as we continued our journey to Zion. We were taught it in as many ways as it took until it was a perfect and powerful truth, until we simply had nothing but him, and it was enough. Changes in the earth. The earth had changed dramatically. The landscape had changed. Mountains had been flattened. Valleys had been heaved up. Rivers had changed course and created new lakes. Roads that used to lead to a city now led to a canyon or into a lake. Most roads were no longer passable, and for this reason, most cars and trucks had been abandoned. Horses became the gold standard of transportation. In the devastated areas, if you had a horse, a warm shelter, and something to eat, you were wealthy. But there were also areas of the country we passed through that were pristine. There were towns and communities in out-of-the-way places that had not been devastated, and where basic utilities had been restored. Sometimes we were invited into homes to shelter, or sometimes into steak centers to take showers or eat. The smaller towns were succeeding more quickly at reestablishing law and order than the bigger cities. They all came to the point of guarding their borders day and night to secure their peace. We had little trouble convincing these guards to let us enter. They welcomed us, and we blessed them, taught them, shared news and meals with them, and then left them without fear into the Lord's keeping. I found it interesting that many of the bridges were still intact. The roads leading up to them were often broken up, but many bridges somehow survived. We spent about 40% of our time on old roads, and the remainder going cross-country. We found the open land easier to navigate and with less human interference. Our habit was to camp far outside of a town or city and to send a small unarmed group into the city to trade or to gather people in. We proceeded with a great deal of caution, and not until we had obtained the word of the Lord to guide us. The larger cities were far more dangerous to approach or enter. Our groups always returned with what we needed. They also often returned with stories of miraculous interventions where the Lord had preserved them and provided the object of their mission. Sometimes they returned with stories of marvelous healings and other blessings they had left upon the people who had been kind and receptive. When bridges were gone, we had to divert far from the bridge to some place where the slopes were gradual. There we could descend into the valley, ford the river, and then trudge back up to the top. There were times when some of our vehicles became badly stuck or swamped in the rivers. Sometimes we pulled them out with the big truck. Other times we left them behind. If a vehicle broke, our mechanics fixed it with parts we had, or we left it behind. There was little fuel, and nearly half the population as before, so perfectly serviceable vehicles of every type just sat where they ran out of fuel. Upon occasion, we left one of our damaged vehicles behind and claimed better ones we found abandoned on the roads and fields. When we approached larger cities, we occasionally came upon foreign troops. We would stop and let them approach us. Most often, we had known before the start of the day's journey that we would meet them. We had a show we put on for them. We acted the part of wanderers, with little or nothing among us, basically headed north with no real destination. We actually were not a threat, and we made sure this was obvious. It wasn't a difficult part to play. We appeared to be a caravan of a few strong leaders, leading crying babies and tired women, complaining teens, and stumbling old men to an undetermined new home. In fact, the only small deception was that we knew very well where we were going. The rest of what they saw was the truth. The odd thing was that they never questioned where we had gotten our big truck. They even searched it occasionally, but never seemed to actually see that it was one of their own. It seemed almost invisible to them. The foreign troops would check our identity and look for military-grade weapons. They were rough and authoritative, but not hostile at this point. They didn't care where we were going as long as we were not breaking their new laws. We had a few hunting rifles, but we never hid them. The troops didn't care about such things. I should mention that we never fired those weapons at people. If we were approached by a hostile group, sometimes we would display them as a show of force, and they would leave us alone. But I do not recall ever firing them, except if some individual did so to obtain food. As time progressed, we ceased killing game for food because it no longer felt necessary. We went up through Idaho in a zigzag fashion, following the voice of the Spirit, gathering those we were shown. Our group was growing in size, with more mouths to feed. Our biggest effort was teaching those who joined us. These new people soon caught the spirit of our camp and became considerable assets to our company. Everybody had a job, and everybody worked unselfishly. Even the teens and youth worked hard, sometimes after a little complaining, but we just smiled at them, praying silently, and they joined in willingly after that. The leaves were just beginning to change color when we passed into Montana. There was a lot of damage in the cities here, more so than we had seen in Idaho. There was also a lot of lawlessness and chaos. Various gangs claimed regions of the city and defended them, not letting people in or out without their permission, usually after paying tribute. The roads into the various parts of the city were heavily guarded. There was an economy of sorts working there, and some basic utilities had been restored. These bands or gangs preyed upon the people, taking part of their food in exchange for protecting them from other gangs. We exercised due caution to avoid conflict with these bands. We were constantly on guard from those who feigned friendship or need in order to steal from us. We used the priesthood and relied upon the Lord to direct us to safety. Each night we set up watches that rotated every 4 hours. When we determined by our spiritual gifts that people came peacefully, we fed them and shared our basic supplies. We rarely told them who we were or where we were ultimately going. All of these groups had their own destination and left us within a few days. We gave them what they needed, and if they had faith, we healed them by the priesthood. If a group we encountered was LDS, and the Spirit led us to, we would disclose who we were and where we were going and invite them to join us. But most often, they also went their own way. Every day we cooked large community meals and ate together. It was basic food without frills, often without meat, but we thrived because we were being changed, even though most of our company could not yet understand what we were being changed into. Zion in Canada. It took us all summer and fall to arrive in Cardston, Canada. Remember that even though I was experiencing this on the ground, it was still a visionary experience. I was not actually there. My body was lying in my bed, waiting for my spirit to return. My spirit was being shown these things in vision. My reason for reminding you of this is that time was compressed for me. In the beginning, I saw every day and every step of our journey. The closer we got to Canada, the more I just saw important events and major places. The vision began jumping forward, skipping periods of time. This left me without a clear concept of how much time had elapsed. The passage of time got even more confusing when we finally arrived in Zion, but I will save those details for the proper place in the story. We found a large gathering of saints in Cardston, not far from the temple. I estimate there were 20,000 people there already, and more arriving daily. They had erected a small city on a large tract of farmland a short distance from the temple. It was all organized and orderly. There were many local people who were expecting us and who had prepared to receive us. The land we settled onto held a few scattered buildings, barns, storage facilities, and homes on the property. These became parts of the new town, the stores and meeting places. This settlement was not destined to remain a tent city, though there were many tents, travel trailers, motorhomes, and every other type of shelter imaginable in the beginning. The brethren were following a plan, building permanent housing and other structures. There were large stores of food and water. A clear river ran to the east of our camp and provided a source of water. The city was lit by electricity, with streetlights and lights in tents and trailers. I knew that electricity was being produced somewhere in the camp, but I do not remember hearing a large generator running. I don't know where it was coming from, and I don't recall seeing the power flicker or fail. There were hospitals, schools, cafeterias, and every other needed service and facility. We were arriving nearly a year after this gathering had begun, and things were more permanent and orderly than they had been a year ago. The church had taken charge, and the tent city quickly evolved into an organized and safe place with basic needs filled. Men and women were put to work building a permanent city here. There was no money. They had all things in common, and they were happy. The people welcomed us without suspicion. They had been expecting our arrival for days. We were the first to arrive, but other groups that had left Salt Lake City at the same time, with other assignments, began arriving every few days. They had left as hundreds and were arriving as thousands. Some had come through California, Oregon, and Washington, and had inspiring and interesting tales to tell of their journey. We greeted these almost as Alma and the sons of Mosiah. We fell upon their necks and rejoiced, glorying in the work our God had accomplished by their hands. The camp was enclosed by a fence, but not a barricade or fortress like we had seen in cities in Montana. Here, there was safety and peace. The guards at the gate did not carry weapons. If defense was necessary, it was by divine intervention. I was aware that there were other gathering places like this throughout the United States, Europe, South America, and anywhere the Stakes of Zion had been fully organized prior to the earthquakes. The power of God had infused the church, which had arisen to full capability throughout the world. The church had a worldwide communication system in place, and they led us with inspired counsel and kept us informed of world events. We were shown a place to camp and were given food and places to sleep. We did not stay as a company, but spread throughout the city on various assignments according to our several skills and abilities. I was invited to go with our 12 to report to the brethren in Cardston. We walked a modest distance to the temple, where the church leadership had offices. We were surprised, though perhaps we should not have been, when we met with two members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles there in the church offices in Canada. What amazed us most was that they had not traveled with any of the companies, and there was no such thing as commercial transportation, nor any road system that connected us. They had arrived months ahead of us. How they had traveled here was unknown to anyone but themselves. It was never explained to us how they got there ahead of us, though years later, when we finally arrived in Zion, such things were commonplace and no longer surprising at all. We reported on our journey. We had kept records of every city we ministered to, and every person who had left with us, joined us, died along the way, and finally arrived with us. They thanked us most warmly and gratefully, and like we had heard about Adam on Diamond, they accepted our report and told us, "Well done." Conference in Cardston. The brethren in Cardston announced that we would enjoy another conference that October. A temporary stage was erected with lights and an adequate PA system. The conference was literally standing room only, as there were few chairs. People brought blankets to sit upon the hillside, or they stood. We felt it a sublime privilege to be there, and I heard nobody complain. When we had arrived in Canada, we had rejoiced as a company and as reunited friends. Now we met and rejoiced as a city. I imagine there were 30,000 people gathered in that field, and the spirit of unity and joy was powerful. There was a mourning for the dead, lost family in the earthquakes, and sacrifices on the trail to this part of Zion. But our minds were focused on the joy of these times that had been so long anticipated, seen in vision, and written of in Scripture. Our hearts were one in thinking, "It has finally occurred. It has finally happened. We survived. We survived the cleansing. We survived the journey, and here we are." We all felt anxious to leave Cardston and get on to Missouri to build Zion, usher in the millennium, and receive Christ when he came. Much of the talk and speculation prior to conference was regarding who would leave first and how soon. Many expected this camp in Cardston to be temporary. I think everyone there expected to continue walking on to the New Jerusalem. Conference began with a large choir singing the hymns of Zion. The senior member of the 12 then in Cardston conducted. The first talk was teaching us that few of us were actually going on to Missouri, and that this place would be developed into a city as glorious and large as the center of Zion. This caused some disappointment as people realized they were not going to be sent to Zion. We learned later that some groups were being sent to Asia, Europe, and other faraway places to bolster the saints and to build up Zion cities across the world. We learned in this conference that there were already a group who had arrived in Zion, as well as some members of the 12 Apostles, and that the temple construction there had already begun. One of the Apostles stood and reported on the great conference in Salt Lake City and on the changes in the world. He spoke about our duty to build, beautify, and maintain these various new cities of Zion that that were even now being built. There were several groups who had arrived from South America, and they stood and reported on their journey. They did not speak English, but everyone understood them, and they understood us. Though they insisted they were speaking and hearing their own language, even as we were hearing and speaking English. From then on, we no longer thought about language in the same way. We accepted this change as one of the miracles of the latter days, and vital to our missions to gather in from all the world into Zion. The groups who had come through California and other paths reported briefly on their journey and told of the miracles of faith they had enjoyed. They also mentioned the vast changes in the landscape and sweeping changes in society. There was no mention of the foreign troops or what they were doing because it was inconsequential and all subject to God's plan, not their own. The conference lasted all through the day. It was approximately October, but it was not cold. The weather was mild, and even just a sweater being overly warm at times. Even the nights and evenings were mild. We all watched and wondered at these changes. After that conference, the saints were strengthened. It had given us a much broader view of what was happening and what we were going to do next. The difference in us was like reading stories about the Exodus of the children of Israel, and then hearing the same story from someone who had actually been there. Every heart there turned to viewing these days as the end of times, not just a global earthquake. Waiting in Cardston. There was a lot of conversation about how soon the second coming was going to be. There were so many visible changes in the earth, our priesthood, and our bodies, that the people had a hard time telling where we were in the overall scheme of things. There were so many opinions about how these times were unfolding that we could not reconcile it with our present circumstances. Like I said, I was constrained for the most part from speaking of the timetable I understood, because it was not my place to reveal such things to other people. We couldn't get information then as we can now. We no longer had computers, TVs, or radios. The internet had disappeared. We not only craved knowledge of these times, but we also longed to know what was happening in the rest of the world. All of us knew someone, somewhere, who was missing. Most of us wanted to know whether the United States had survived as a nation and what the foreign troops were really up to. People were putting the pieces together, but not necessarily in perfect order. Some people thought the second coming had happened in Salt Lake City when Christ appeared in the conference there. Depending on how much a person had studied and understood the doctrine of the priesthood, and depending upon how powerfully the Spirit had worked upon them in the years prior to this day, some of our group were infants in their understanding. Their ideas did not cause contention, but made it harder for them to see their own future unfolding. Many sermons and special meetings were held and dedicated to these subjects. Our leaders urged us not to worry about the times, world events, national intrigue, or wars, but to wait upon the Lord and just keep moving forward. Significant things had happened in the last year, so there was no sense of doubt that we were on the cusp of the second coming. We knew the times were advancing rapidly. During the conference, we had received our assignments and had once again been divided into companies. We were anxious to go forth and finish our assignments, to create our part of Zion so that the second coming could occur. We had received our marching orders, and at least for now, it was enough to prepare to leave as soon as we got the word to head out. The civic authorities in Canada and the foreign troops there were not initially pleased that we were taking care of ourselves and were not a drain on their resources. However, as our numbers grew larger, they became concerned that we would gather in more people than we could support and would begin asking them for food or resources. Canada had been hit hard in some areas, especially along the coasts, but in Cardston there was far less damage. The temple there had suffered only minor damage. We considered Cardston a permanent dwelling, and the locals considered us temporary. There began to be some conflicts where local people tried to steal food or start fights. Our leaders released the people after giving them food and an invitation to return any time for more. We considered that these altercations were staged to try to give the foreign troops cause to enter our little city and establish martial law, and also take control of our stores of food. They wanted us to disperse, and if we had no food, they reasoned most of us would leave. However, they never succeeded in finding cause against us. Our leaders were inspired in every reaction and had been planning for this day for decades. We planted fruit trees and grains on large tracts of ground and raised animals that produced milk and cheese. We had a huge workforce that could accomplish anything we began in just a few days or weeks. Many buildings were being constructed. These were not clapboard structures, but permanent buildings of fine workmanship made of wood, brick, and stone. During one of the meetings, the brethren showed us a series of large maps that had been drawn long ago. It showed Zion in Missouri as the center of a bullseye, with scores of concentric rings drawn outward from that hub. All across North America, there were cities indicated along these lines, and rings drawn around those cities indicating their planned size. The end result was that the whole continent was covered with evenly spaced cities flowing outward from the center place of Zion. The whole face of the continent was more flat now, with remaining mountains more like big hills than great obstacles to man. There were only small roads drawn to connect all of the cities to one another, and to Zion, but no highways or rails. The city plan included farms, commerce, temples, and every other necessity for a Zion society. Each city could live independently with this plan. I was interested that there was almost no indication of industry on the map, and few roads. Rather than it being an omission, as I initially wondered, I later came to understand that by the time Christ returned and this plan was developed, that there would be no need for industry or roads because the whole world would be living in a millennial condition. There would be no death, no disease, and no needs that could not be met either by cottage industry or by calling upon the power of God. An evolving society. Society was changing. At least it was here in the Cardston city of Zion. The world outside was still in great chaos. Everywhere governments recovered, and they began exerting control, usually in the form of martial law, which led to conflict and civil war. Throughout the world, wars began over everything imaginable. Ethnic and traditional hatred still smoldered, and old borders and treaties had ceased to exist. Even with more than half of the world population gone, these wars outside of Zion ultimately cut the remaining human population by half again. Here in our little part of Zion, our hearts were changing, our bodies were changing, and our spiritual IQ was changing. We still had a fullness of the priesthood, as we first discovered just before the first great conference, and we were learning every day what that meant. It took us years to understand that we had to evolve into Zion, not just march to it. It was a process that involved stripping away everything belonging to the world and replacing it with total faith in God. We had to learn that we did not need anything from the celestial world. All we needed was complete faith in Christ. It was a hard transition to make, but it was one of the reasons our journey to Zion took so many years, not to cover the distance, but to evolve spiritually so that we would be worthy to be in Zion when we actually arrived there. As an illustration, I am reminded of an event that taught us all a great deal. On the first leg of our journey, one of the brethren on the council was a diabetic from childhood. He was able to secure and bring with him a supply of his medication, but after a few months he ran out. He grew sicker day by day until he could not function and could only eat tiny amounts or his blood sugar went dangerously high. He lost weight dramatically and struggled for months. We all began to expect him to die soon. He asked for, and of course, received several priesthood blessings, but he still did not improve. Our ability to heal had been manifest nearly 100% of the time we called upon God. We had seen many miracles of the priesthood, and could not understand why this faithful brother, whom we knew to be righteous, did not recover immediately. We had seen him work miracles himself, and knew he was worthy of the blessings we were calling down upon him, but he did not recover. Then one morning he got up out of bed and announced that he did not need medication anymore. He ate a normal breakfast and was fine ever after that. We asked him what had changed, why he was now healed. He replied, "While I was dying, all I could think of was, why hasn't the Lord led me to more medicine so I can continue my mission for the Lord? I had to get very low and near death to realize that I was asking for the wrong blessing. I had been in the conference center when Jesus Christ showed us all our future labors in vision, and I knew I would arrive in Zion with this company. But I was trying to have the Lord make me arrive on my own terms, which was with my medicine. I humbled myself and told the Lord I would go anywhere he wanted, to Zion or to heaven, and I would go on his terms. He continued, "It just came into my heart that I already knew I would arrive in Zion, and if the Lord had not yet provided medicine, then I obviously didn't need it. I knew it was true. I felt vitality come back into my body, and I got out of bed. The power of God and of His priesthood are manifest in me, and I'm perfectly fine now. I just had to learn that the Lord was my salvation, not a bottle of medicine." We had the priesthood power, but not the spiritual maturity and understanding to use it flawlessly. Like this fine brother, we had to learn how to be of perfect faith and how to release our grip on things as our salvation. There were other lessons we had to learn before we arrived in Zion. If we had fully understood what we had, we could have just traveled to Zion in a heartbeat by the power of God. That knowledge was not revealed to us because we had to walk there, and in the process to be stripped of everything we had except a few rags of clothing, before we learned to rely totally upon God, and to use His priesthood to provide things we had always previously relied upon society and hard work to provide. The law of, "By the sweat of thy brow," had been amended, but it would take us years to grow into that sweet knowledge. Our society was also evolving in the sense that there was not a plan for highways, airports, or trains, because in time the saints would be taught to travel from place to place by the power of God. We knew this was how some of the apostles and other leaders had come to Canada for the last conference, but we did not yet know how to access this blessing for ourselves. There was also no plan for permanent utilities because cities of Zion were to be lit by the power of God. Communication and information was to be implemented through a Urim and Thummim each person would possess, and millennial bodies did not thirst, hunger, or produce waste. Hence, there was no need for utilities. Society was also evolving into an almost pre-industrial age because in time, quite a long time actually, we eventually learned that we no longer had to manufacture anything. In our evolving Zion in Cardston, we built medical clinics and sawmills, and many other small industries to support us now, which some of us knew would eventually have no practical use to us at all. I will have much more to say about this later. In the meantime, we were just waiting to be told it was time to leave Cardston. I waited too, and I served in the temple or anywhere else the Lord called. It was a marvelous time for me. Having been sickly all my life, to now have the power of God and changes to my body giving me unending health and energy, I now felt like a toddler who was learning how to walk. It was a time of wide-eyed discovery for me, and I loved every minute. More than that, I loved the Lord, and grew deeply attached to those with whom I served. We stayed through the winter, or perhaps it was several winters. I'm not sure. Once again, my view of these things began jumping larger and larger periods of time more frequently. I understood it all clearly when I was in the vision, but when I returned to my mortal identity, it was far more than my mortal mind could contain, and some of these complexities were lost to me. The winter was mild, in the 50s and never freezing. Most people spent the time building and working for our common welfare. All of the work was organized, and people rotated from job to job every few days unless they had a specialty, such as medicine or some science. Since I had been an ordnance worker in the temple, I served in the temple day and night, working to complete many thousands of ordinances for people who had arrived, had been taught, and were now ready. There was also a lot of conversation and curiosity about when and where the return of the lost 10 tribes would occur. We knew some companies had been sent to foreign countries, and we speculated that they were gathering in these lost groups. When we gathered for conference or other meetings, we were hungry to learn from these other companies. With all of this wonderment and delightful speculation, there was no doubt all would come to pass as prophesied. We just wanted to know how far things had progressed. During this winter, many small groups arrived. There were companies from Europe and Asia, and a large company who came across a new land bridge from Russia to Alaska, and then down through Alaska and Canada to Cardston. They may not have known who they were, but their patriarchal blessings revealed them as being from one of the so-called lost tribes of Israel. They weren't actually lost. They just didn't know who they were until they arrived. The people who had led them to Cardston were literally angels. To the refugees, these angels were just people who came, gathered them, taught them, baptized and ordained them, all during their years of Exodus. Only a few righteous leaders truly understood who was leading them. To my eyes, they were translated people, some from thousands of years ago, some from these very times. By the time they arrived, these people had been through the very refiner's fire that we had all expected on our journeys. They began in trucks and arrived in rags, but they literally glowed with righteousness and faith when they arrived. Even though I was seeing this in vision, I tell you these are times I will never forget. Whether in the body or out, I was there, and it was magnificent. Around the 1st of April, another conference was held. We received our assignments and destinations to various cities of Zion. We received a detailed report on the New Jerusalem. We were amazed at how much work had already been accomplished in Zion and how long the leadership of the church had been planning and preparing to build in what we used to call Missouri. Many were surprised at their assignments, but there was a growing spirit of righteous willingness among us. One of the difficulties was that the concept of walking to Zion in Missouri had been such a part of Mormon culture for so long that now it was hard to imagine going anywhere else. I didn't hear of anyone refusing or complaining about their new missions. They just made preparations to continue on. Because I had been in the Great Conference in Salt Lake City and had seen the vision of my future mission, as had many people there, I knew a great deal more about our journey beyond Canada than those who had not enjoyed that prophetic experience. When the Spirit moved me, I shared my knowledge, but mostly I was constrained to be silent. I was continually watching and listening to find anyone else who had been in that conference. During the many conversations I had with these blessed people, I found that everyone had seen a vision of their own future. Our individual visions were personalized and different from one another. We told our stories, and by fitting together our various views, we were able to discern a broader picture of what was going to happen, and it was literally stunning to behold. Those of us who had experienced the actual physical change of translation were somewhat different than others. We had clearer view of things and greater spiritual gifts. Unless we were speaking to another translated soul, we kept our translated status and these greater views to ourselves, as the Spirit seemed to require. We were learning that translated people didn't get tired like normal people. Everything took less effort and taxed us less. We recovered quickly and could work long and hard and then recover in a few minutes. We still ate and slept, but we talked amongst ourselves, wondering if eating and sleeping was even necessary. After a big day's work, I felt hungry and tired, but much less than in my previous life. I chose to eat, but it was different. I needed less food, slept better and far shorter, and felt absolutely wonderful. I could awaken in a second, even after just a few minutes of sleep, and feel perfectly awake and ready to go forward. At the end of the day, I was no more fatigued than I was when I slept a full night. I found that injuries, cuts, and scratches healed as fast as I wanted them to. There was no pain, only a realization of the injury. If I ignored it, it healed in days instead of weeks. If I wished it away and prayed to the Father, it would heal in a matter of minutes. I expected in time to be impervious to injury, but I wasn't at this time. I was physically stronger day by day. My mind grew clearer and much quicker. Things that would have taken me long study before now came to me in flashes of understanding. I grew in my abilities to understand complex situations, and I could instantly come up with complex answers that were completely correct and inspired. My hearing was acutely tuned to the word of the Lord. Revelation became constant and unending. I no longer experienced temptations of any kind. I no longer walked through mists of darkness. I didn't hold on to the iron rod because it became a part of me, a part of my soul, what I was. My capacity to love was profoundly enhanced, which made meetings and partings even sweeter and more difficult. If anything had the power to make a translated soul sorrow or feel pain, it was this infusion of charity, because my heart wanted everyone to be blessed, uplifted, and supplied with every need. This wasn't always possible, and people I loved sometimes chose to transgress, and this caused deep sorrow at times. Every new gift I had was focused upon our new mission. The constant companionship of the Holy Ghost was an ever-present reality, and we knew the mind and will of the Lord. There was no guesswork and no more fear. Science and math and even my professional training all seemed to become less important. If you're looking for a solution that would take five engineers with supercomputers, and the answer just enters your mind as revelation, there's no point in checking it against mortal sciences. You already had the answer. This new thinking was not an upgrade to our IQ. It was a lifting of the veil to reveal what we already were. Some of us had participated in the creation of worlds before we were born, and those divine sciences we understood then were slowly piercing the mortal veil, replacing mortal sciences. It was fascinating to watch our society leap forward, even while becoming simpler, less industrial, and non-commercial, with no consumer mindset. We would come to discover the truth of all these questions over time. For now, it was like slowly unwrapping presents on Christmas morning, seeking to enjoy the process of discovery as much as the presents inside. To my spiritual eyes, translated people just looked different. I could discern them far off. So when I had the chance to talk with another newly translated person, we occasionally took the time to discuss what all this meant and what experiences and new priesthood gifts we had experienced. We compared our experiences from the Great Conference and tried to piece together a larger picture. The more I learned, the more I realized that even with this great view of my own life ahead, I knew but a tiny part of the whole. It was a good grounding and humbling realization for me. We also knew that even though the gift of translation had been fully given to us, that we were still in the process of becoming, of learning our duties and our abilities, and when it was appropriate to use them. When I met an old translated being, there was a power and righteous serenity about them that I did not possess. Seeing and experiencing their highly developed state motivated me to yield to whatever process I needed to endure to become fully evolved in my new status. I knew I was changing. I also knew it was going to take years for the process to be fully implemented. There was a direct and constant influence of the Holy Ghost in the camps that could not be denied. It was a new phenomenon among the saints that had begun the day of the Great Conference. Everyone was adjusting to this new level of spiritual power. There was a lot of conversation about whether this was the millennial state or if it was part of the process to the greater change of translation. About this time, transoceanic travel became possible again via ships at sea. The different cities of Zion around the world had been established and fortified. Many groups from Canada were assigned to travel to these smaller cities and to gather the elect along the way. Companies also left from Salt Lake City and other Zion cities to go forth and gather. This work was all directed by the apostles from Salt Lake City. The church had a working telecommunication network before the tribulations began, but we were learning to use a more perfect system. It began to function because the power of God was being made manifest in greater degree among us. Just as the two apostles had arrived in Cardston by divine means, man-made communication systems slowly became obsolete. Leaving Cardston. We prepared to leave throughout that winter. It was March when we bid our new homes and new friends goodbye. We were headed to the center place of Zion in former Missouri, and we left with a song in our hearts. Our company was smaller, perhaps 300 people, including families. We took our big military vehicle loaded with supplies, as well as a few pickups. Fuel was not abundant, but in Canada there were a few refineries still in operation, and we traded for fuel. We left feeling fearless. We had seen so many miracles that we could imagine nothing but the Lord's constant care and protection. We feared neither man nor army, seen or unseen. I was called in and sat with one of the apostles then in Cardston. He greeted me most graciously. He was a newly translated soul himself, and we greeted each other with an embrace like brothers from childhood. He set me apart for my new assignment at the temple in the New Jerusalem. This was the reason I was in this company and not going somewhere else. I knew all of the live ordinances from my prior service in temples before the tribulations and while in Canada. I was assigned to take this knowledge to Missouri, establish the ordinances, and train others. I was, of course, thrilled. It was a part of my journey that I had not foreseen. I had seen in vision that I would arrive in Zion, but not what I would do once there. As we had done in the first leg of our journey, we began with a council meeting, which quickly resulted in our knowing the mind of the Lord and the destination of our first day's journey. We presented this to our camp, and it was sustained. We knelt in prayer, ate breakfast, one last time in Cardston, and left out of the southern gate. We were headed back into Montana. The trucks trundled along a little faster and were soon out of sight. We walked and sang and wondered. This leg of our journey felt simplified. We were not assigned to gather as many. We were not carrying as many supplies, and we had fewer belongings. We were well past the work it out in your own mind, then ask if it be right phase of revelation. We awoke each morning knowing the will of the Lord. We knew what to do, how to do it, and how it would come out. We ceased to make mistakes. We were always where we needed to be, at the right moment, with the right words and the power to accomplish the Lord's will. We could approach a total stranger and know their exact circumstances and needs. We could say, "Your husband is at home dying. Your young son died just last night, and your husband asked you to go get help. You are hungry and exhausted and terrified. We will help you, but we need to come to your home and give him a blessing and raise your young son from the dead. Will you take us there?" They felt the love and faith in our voices, and miracles occurred. After experiencing these type of miracles day after day, we looked forward to each new morning with joy. We just kept thinking, "Behold the majesty of the Lord," and we went forward without fear. For me, there was a dual identity. I was in that company, participating in these glorious days, but I knew in my heart that this was a vision. Boy, I did not want to go back into my mortal body. I wanted to be in the company of Zion. Even though I realized that I was seeing a future event, it was so real that I was living it. I was there, and it was reality. It was so real that it was hard to remember that my real reality, my true self, was lying in a bed in Utah, and my spirit was seeing future events. Those of us who were translated soon paired off and took the opportunity to speak of our blessings. The other person in our company was a woman in her 50s. I'll call her Rachel. I had actually known Rachel from her youth. My relationship with her was like father to daughter. I had been involved in her youth as an advisor and confidant. We had both been in the first great conference and had both been translated that moment. She was humble about her gift, but had some difficulty accepting that she really was ready or that she was the right person for these gifts. She wanted reassurance and the instruction from me on how to progress, which I did not have. We were in the same boat, so to speak. She woke up each morning almost expecting her gifts to be gone. Finally, she realized that these changes were permanent, and she ceased to worry. From then on, she was inspired, intelligent, and organized. She was the women's leader in our group. She was like a Relief Society president. She counseled with the women and gave out daily assignments. She was also a spiritual leader. I remember talks she gave to the whole company. There were times when her words rallied the group and gave us all courage to face impossible obstacles, depending wholly upon the Lord. She was married, and her husband was with us. He was a great man, one of our council. His responsibility was the youth of the company. He was a man of faith, but he was not translated like his wife. This gave him some doubts about his own righteousness. He was not slack or faithless or doubting in any way. He just questioned his own capacity and wondered why he could not do the things he wanted to do. He felt like he was of less worth, which in fact was not true. His condition and his calling were perfect for him, and it was all engineered to bless and prepare him for his full endowment of power. He came from a background of success and confidence, and his journey was taking him through humility and reliance upon the Lord. His wife came from a background of humility and doubting her worth, and her journey was taking her to see herself through the eyes of God and embracing her own worth. From this point on in the vision, the journey was shown to me as a series of snapshot scenes. I was no longer participating in the events, but was watching them from a distance, as if on a large screen. The vision was still showing me things that would happen, but I was no longer an actor. I was now a spectator. Each of the following vignettes occurred this way. The first vignette. The first vignette caught up with my company just north of Wyoming. I don't know how much time had elapsed, but it must have been at least a few months. The season was later in the year. I saw that they had been attacked several times by the foreign troops with the blue-green helmets. They were trying to stop our journey into Missouri. I don't know what their motive was. Perhaps they also knew of the city that was quickly growing there and feared that it would become a source of political solidarity that could challenge their dominance. I was never told why. I just saw that they robbed us of food and fuel, killed some of us, and tried to intimidate us into turning back. They had blown up bridges to stop our progress, and they threatened to kill us all if we did not turn back. It was at this time that we were also attacked by a band of armed thugs who attempted to rob us, but we had nothing. Instead, they kidnapped some of our beautiful young people. It was an awful, horrifying moment, but instead of intimidating us, it did the opposite. The foreign troops were trying to take over the government of the nation and all local governments. The Latter-day Saints were the largest organized body of people remaining from the old world, and thus they saw us as their biggest threat, even though we gave them no reason to fear us. Their assignment was to break down all organized groups, including all religious organizations. Our aims were manifestly not political, and they knew this. We had been instructed that we were not to take part in any political process, or to give our allegiance to any government entity, no matter who it was. Our vision, or the vision the Lord had instilled in our minds, was that we were preparing Zion for the return of Jesus Christ, and that he would soon reign as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We were not trying to rebuild the nation. We were trying to build the kingdom of God. We knew he would subdue all enemies under his feet when he came, and we need not participate in that process. We were united in our great relief that this was the case. We were sick of the world and everything we left behind. Our only desire was for Christ to come and end this celestial world of tears. The foreign troops knew we had a plan, which we were accomplishing. They perceived that we were organized, well-governed, and determined to accomplish this plan. They also knew our plan had something to do with Missouri, so they took up position to stop us. They didn't even know why we were going there, but they believed stopping us would destroy us. They didn't realize it wasn't our plan, but God's, and they were powerless to stop us. It was disconcerting to me to jump from seeing our company as a joyful and powerful company of Zion suddenly reduced to a ragtag group of struggling survivors. The change had happened quickly. I saw myself among the group, and I was now watching myself in these circumstances as if in a 3D diorama. It made perfect sense in the vision, but is a little hard to explain or even fathom as a mortal. The foreign troops' aggression proved our earlier realization that they really were our enemy, and they saw us the same way. We went to great lengths to avoid them and not meet or interact with them. They, on the other hand, began to hunt us. They grew from harassing and robbing us to setting up ambushes to destroy us entirely. In addition to the foreign troops, there were armed bands of thugs. These bandits were generally defectors from the foreign troops or were brigands from all around. They were well supplied and heavily armed. They had robbed us many times and kidnapped some of our youth. We were just struggling to continue our journey. As I looked upon my little company from the distance of the vision, I saw that this opposition had the opposite effect our enemies hoped. I saw our spiritual strength growing and our courage and reliance upon God and the priesthood increase dramatically. I saw that there were great miracles in the camp. Tiny supplies fed many people, and they did not dwindle with use. Water was found or provided by miraculous means. We were led to areas by the Lord that exactly met our needs for that day. We grew from courageous to fearless, in spite of the overwhelming obstacles and losses we faced. As soon as we ceased to fear, we awoke one morning to a new phenomenon. There was a pillar of light in the front of our camp and one at our rear. The bright light was a pillar about 30 feet tall. It was observable to our enemies as well. It was a literal light and was visible by day and by night. It went before us and behind us, and it terrified our enemies. The light didn't come from heaven or from the earth. It was self-contained, as if the power of the light was the light itself. At first, we did not know what its function was. Some in our company wondered if it would make us more visible to our enemies, but this fear quickly evaporated. We could walk up to the light and touch it. It was comforting and healing. We would take those who were injured, ill, or starving and exhausted, and we would leave them within or near the light, and they would quickly be healed. The light also healed sadness, fear, and confusion. Before the light began, we often felt discouraged or saddened by loss. Now we felt great comfort and peace to go with our previous fearlessness. We no longer met in council to decide our day's journey because we knew in our souls the way we should go, and the light led us